Your support is important to Living on Earth. Donate today by pressing the donate link on the left of this page. Every bit helps. And thanks.
Now, the scaly-foot snail is not the only creature to inspire the military-minded. The Romans observed the tortoise and created the testudo, an ingenious method of overlapping their shields to block incoming arrows and such. Camouflage and mimicry in nature have long amazed and at times frustrated humans. Just how did the leaf-like mantis or walking stick gain the ability to disappear before our eyes? And how does a benign butterfly manage to imitate its toxic cousins? Peter Forbes dives into those questions in his book Dazzled and Deceived, Mimicry and Camouflage. It's a thorough history of the scientists and soldiers who tried to understand and apply some of nature's best tricks. Hello, Mr. Forbes.
Hi there.
So why mimicry and camouflage? What drew you to this subject?
Well, the great thing about mimicry is that, I mean, sometimes in evolution you see some weird creature and you think, how did that evolve and why? But with mimicry, the fact is you've got two things that look the same. So you see what must have happened, that they gain some advantage, that they hide that way. So in a sense, they're like artists, seeing a pretty pattern and copying it.
This is a real challenge for evolutionary theory to explain how these things came to be.
Well, it's a challenge that it's still running, this challenge, actually, because there's a lot of debate about the mechanisms of evolution, not about that it happened, but how does one creature get to look like another? You can see if one creature looks quite a lot like another, and one creature is dangerous, so predators leave it alone, the one that looks a bit like the other one will get to look more like it, because the ones that aren't very good mimics will get picked off by predators. But the big problem is, how does it start? And actually, I mean, Darwin wrote his book 150 years ago, and the biologists are still arguing about exactly how does it start.
You know, I had one of these moments recently at the aquarium here in Boston with my daughter, and we're looking at the leafy sea dragon. And I'm looking at that thing with all of its Baroque appendages, and it's such a perfect match, and you just think, you can easily slip into this, gee, there must have been a design kind of thinking to that. And a lot of scientists fell into that trap. I noticed that throughout your book.
Well, I'm glad you saw the leafy sea dragon. It's one of my favourites. But, I mean, it really does look like seaweed. But, I mean, why would anything get designed to look like seaweed? I mean, the actual designer really is the seaweed that the dragon lives among. I mean, it is a predator, so it needs to hide so that the things that it eats can't see it.
So this debate was kind of raging in science about the mechanisms that would produce mimicry and camouflage in animals. And then along came World War I, and the scientists felt compelled, I guess, to offer what they had learned from nature for the war effort.
Yes. I mean, in the 1890s, Albert Thayer, an American artist and naturalist, formulated some ideas about camouflage, counter-shading, and he communicated these ideas to some biologists in England. So when war started in 1914, they tried to tell the War Department that in modern warfare, you're going to need camouflage. The weapons were bigger and stronger. I mean, in the old days, soldiers used to go into battle wearing red so that they could be identified. But once you got a machine gun, this wasn't a very good idea when you got a machine gun firing at you. You need to hide your troops, and you need to hide your ships. You need to try to hide everything.
And was Mr. Thayer persuasive?
Well, Thayer was an amazing character. He's one of the central figures in my book. But Thayer was obsessed. He was obsessed that ships had to have all kinds of crazy ideas to camouflage them. In fact, he even suggested rigging them out so that they looked like clouds on the horizon, things like that. But unfortunately, in the First World War, mostly the authorities didn't listen to the naturalists. They actually did listen to an artist, though.
So the naturalists were bringing what they thought were the best ideas for camouflage, but artists had their own ideas. How did that play out?
There's this story. Gertrude Stein was with Picasso when the war started, and they saw some camouflage tanks coming down the street. And Picasso said, "Cubism, that is cubism. We made that. We made camouflage." Now, it wasn't quite as simple as that, but there were painters in the French camouflage corps. who were quite clearly influenced by Cubism. And in fact, more artists were involved, really, in the camouflage effort than naturalists. And the naturalists got rather aggrieved because they thought, look, we discovered this first. We know how creatures whose life, it's life and death for them, whether they escape a predator. Therefore, it must be relevant to human warfare. But the painters said, look, we know all about how to break up forms and to hide things. We're the experts in the visual world. So trust us. So there was a kind of battle went on between artists and naturalists.
And who won there in the World War One era?
Well, in World War One, I guess you have to say that the artists won, because an English artist called Norman Wilkinson came up with this idea of dazzle painting, which rather turned ships into kind of zebras. And this wasn't to hide them, because he said you can't hide ships on the sea. It was to create a confusing jangle to confuse the rangefinders of the periscopes of the submarines that were hunting them.
Did it end up doing any good? Did it save boats from getting hit by U-boat torpedoes?
I mean, one month you'd see that the dazzle ships seemed to have had a much better survival rate. Then the next month you see it didn't seem to be true. And actually, when the war was over, the Navy's authorities said, in future we won't do dazzle. But as I say, although they started Second World War with grey ships, camouflage did start to come back again. But this time, it was really it wasn't dazzle. It actually was the naturalist's idea of using soft tones and trying to counter the effect of light and shadow.
So the influence of naturalists in camouflage, they really reached their peak in the desert in World War II.
So I think the battle in the desert, which was fantastically improvised, and of course it's very hard to hide in the desert, this was the thing. You couldn't really hide, but you could make one thing look like another. The Battle of El Alamein was a massive deception operation where they actually disguised the tanks as trucks. They actually created a dummy army in a place where they weren't going to attack. They created a railhead which was just made out of palm fronds. They put up dummy flares to track the planes to this dummy railhead. You know, they even had a locomotive that was smoking and dummy men around it. They used every trick in the book. That's the high point of that kind of huge, huge scale camouflage that could only happen before the modern electronic era of warfare.
And the guy who was the main force behind this, very interesting guy, Kott, is that his name?
Yes, Hugh Kott was really the man in camouflage and mimicry, the naturalist in the mid-20th century. He wrote the classic book, which is still unsurpassed, really. The strange thing was he joined the military and became a camouflage instructor and went to the desert. And it must be the only big natural history tome ever was packed into soldiers' kit bags, because it was the recommended reading that you had to learn from nature if you're going to be a desert camoufleur.
So you actually had soldiers carrying around this natural history textbook with them.
Absolutely, and it's quite a big book, yeah.
but it paid off, because Montgomery was able to fool the desert fox, Rommel.
Absolutely, yes. Churchill himself was very, very keen on camouflage activities. So the British approach was to actually use as much of this kind of deception as possible. And Hugh Kott was there as the brains behind the training of the camouflagers in the desert.
You know, it's pretty ironic here that the whole point of mimicry and camouflage is so that you can't see it. And yet, by looking at it closely, we've gained great insight for, you know, decades and decades.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, the whole business of trying to hide or trying to, you know, be so like another creature that you get a quiet life because that creature is so dangerous because things leave it alone. By trying to hide somehow or other, it's a technique that for us, we look at the creatures who do this and we think, aha, you know, this can tell us a lot about how nature works.
Well, the book is just fascinating. It's called Dazzled and Deceived, Mimicry and Camouflage. Peter Forbes, thanks very much.
Thank you.
On the next Living on Earth, researchers find a novel way to drive destructive beetles crazy.
Well, I've been able to watch a male mate with a female two or three times, and then all of a sudden turn on that female and kill her. He'll chew her to pieces. You know, that's not natural.
And the secret is sound. Listening to the Beatles next time on Living on Earth. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Balinski, Bruce Gellerman, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Shrieskanjaraja, and Mitra Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins, Marilyn Gavoni, and Sammy Sousa. Our interns are Emily Guerin and Bridget McDonald. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Learish-Dean composed our themes. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. You can find us anytime at loe.org. I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science. And Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners. The Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues. And Pax World Mutual Funds, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making. On the web at paxworld.com. Pax World, for tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.